Hello, you're listening to the Retro Hour, episode 14, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news, views, and interviews. I'm Ravi Abbott.
And I'm Dan Wood, and here we are into the month of April already.
Oh, it's madness, and we've got some madness going on in April, haven't we, Dan?
We have. Well, this is actually going to be one of our busiest months now that we're kind of getting into the summer season, as it were. Plenty of events coming up starting. There's an event for the Amiga Heads coming up at the end of this month in London, celebrating Amiga Power magazine.
Yeah. It's organised by The Guardian, Gaming. We've talked about it before. And it's on the 21st of April.
Yeah, it's on a Thursday evening, isn't it, in London. Yeah. All the information on our website if you want to come along. But Ravi and I are going to be there.
Yeah, it should be good, a 90-minute talk by all the Amiga old-school journalists, you know?
Amiga Power was always kind of the rebellious magazine, wasn't it?
So, yeah, the cheeky one.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see who turns up for that one, I think, and who's going to be on stage. Then after that, of course, the big one at the end of the month.
Oh, yeah, we've got Play Blackpool. Now, we've been to Play Manchester before, but we've never been to Blackpool. And we hear Blackpool's more of a kind of community thing.
I haven't been to Blackpool since I was about 7 years old.
Yeah, we're going to get some rock and look at the illuminations and stuff.
Those sandcastles.
Yeah, that'd be good.
So that's coming up. I think it's fair to say Play is probably the biggest retro event of the year, isn't it?
Yeah, and RGDS have invited us for a nice little meet-up with the other podcast guys.
Yeah, so Andy got in touch with us from RGDS, and apparently they do this little thing every year where they get all of the podcast, UK podcast guys together, like Tenpence Arcade are there, Maximum Power Up, the Dreamcast Junkyard, and they all get together and kind of do this big like meetup and recording.
Yeah, there's
together,
some Retro Asylum guys there as well, so it should be good.
That's been the new kids on the block, so it'll be interesting to see how that goes.
Yeah, fellow podcastees.
Now, the way the show works, if you are new to it, every week Ravi and I run through the big technology and retro gaming stories of the week for about half an hour. Yep. And then we have an interesting guest who is noteworthy from the history of computing and gaming, and you've got a good one lined up this week.
Yeah, Jim Bagley. So Jim Bagley has done coding for over 23 years. So he started on the 8-bit systems, and he's gone all the way to modern games consoles. But also what he's doing is he's doing a lot of these demakes that we've been talking about, which is old school retro games and kind of shoving them on lower-end systems.
Yeah, yeah.
So he did for the ZX81, Dragon's Lair. And he's actually got the Guinness World Record for the biggest game for the ZX81.
Dragon's Lair. Even that was like a Laserdisc game, wasn't it? It was
massive. He had to invent a video player to play Dragon's Lair on the machines.
And this is a guy, you know, even back in the old days, stuff like Doom on the Sega Saturn he did, didn't he?
He's done lots of ports. He's also worked on a lot of systems that people really ignored over the time, like the Amstrad CPC, because no one else is doing it. So Jim stepped up.
Yeah, it should be interesting. He's going to be on the show in around 35 minutes from now. Before that, then, into this week's big stories then, Ravi. And this is finally something we've been waiting for what, about a year now?
Yeah, for a long time. I think a lot of Amiga heads and also PlayStation 4 people have just been waiting, because it's been massively hyped.
And I am both.
Yep. And it's the Shadow of the Beast remake. It actually gets a release date.
When's it coming out then?
17th of May.
Yeah, well, it's we first, I think, was it last year, the year before that this first got announced?
I think it's been about 2-3 years it's been going on.
Well, this is it's a PS4 exclusive, isn't it? So, I mean, anyone that loves Shadow of the Beast, I think the Amiga was probably the main platform that it was on. But it apparently features 60 frames a second. It's a full HD upgrade. And it's a PS4 exclusive as well. And I think our buddy Echo, he's done the music for it, hasn't he?
Yeah. This should be epic, because they've had no music in any of the trailers yet. So I'm really interested to see, because David Whittaker did the old soundtrack.
Yeah.
It was just beautiful, you know.
Yeah, so we'll keep you posted on that. And links will be in the show notes that you can get every week from our website, theretrohour.com. Now, we've mentioned a couple of these kind of pixel art books on the show in the past. And there's a new crowdfunder that's just started for The Little Book of ZX Spectrum Games.
Sounds nice.
This is Chris Wilkins. He's the guy that did the Commodore 64 book a while back. I think he did like an Ocean Software one as well.
Ah, okay.
So this is essentially that. I mean, these are really good coffee table books. It's just a lot of old art from your favourite games, blown up, kind of in that retro gamer magazine style where everything's kind of, you know, enhanced so it looks really blocky on the pages, and it'll bring back a load of memories looking through them as well.
I think the Speccy games had a certain look as well, because it was always a black background with, like, you know,
neon as well,
colours.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
I used to love the look of Spectrum games. You know, you see them on the back of, like, screenshots on the back of games and stuff like that. I never I had a Spectrum for about 5 minutes and I blew it up. that's my previous with the Spectrum, I'm afraid. My mum got me one for free off a friend at work, and I plugged the wrong power supply into it and fried it.
Oh, dear.
I was young and stupid. But yes, I've never really actually had a Spectrum apart from... I remember once when Amiga Computing magazine gave away a floppy disk, and it had a Spectrum emulator for the Amiga on there.
Ah.
And it had... it was like a Batman... like 3D kind of isometric game.
Okay.
I think it was actually quite a famous Spectrum game, and that came included on the disc. So I did used to play a few of the Spectrum games on that. But yeah, I mean, you're right, I've always quite liked the graphical style of the Spectrum. It's
I went to my friend's house in Hull when I was younger, and he actually had a Spectrum. And I thought, oh, this is, you know, old school, these graphics are rubbish. But he showed me some of the games. How to Be a Complete Bastard was one, which is really
Monty Python,
isn't it? Yeah, and Escape from Colditz as well. And all these games had really good personality. So, you know, they were still worth playing then.
Yeah, yeah.
And they still are.
I think the Spectrum is quintessentially a British system, though, isn't it? And it's... you know, I think this is really cool, though, as well. I mean, even looking at the cover of, you know, these proposed covers that he's got here, he needs to raise money for this, so it's on Fusion funding at the moment. And, you know, based on his previous successes with the 64 and the Ocean book, I'm sure he'll reach his target in no time at all. But just having that, you know, the Sinclair stripe there and the old logo, it makes you nostalgic, even as someone that didn't really own that platform back then. Just seeing it does take me back, though.
Yeah, it's a nice little platform, and I think... Jim will be telling us a lot about the Speccy as well, because I think it's one of his faves.
Yeah, so if it's one of your favourite platforms as well, The Story of the Sinclair ZX Spectrum in Pixels is the name of this book, and we'll drop you the links if you want to.
Maybe you could get your Spectrum Vega Plus and just have it sitting on top of the book at the coffee table when that comes out. It could look really
ultimate
nice.
Hipster.
Yeah.
Now, here's a platform that we've not covered on the show before, the Apple II.
The Apple II, yes. So hundreds of lost Apple II games have been added to the Internet Archive, which is... archive.org.
Yeah, one of our favourite websites.
Totally, totally. And I don't know if you know that cracking games kind of started on the Apple II.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the first formats that they were cracking on. So there must be a lot of these games. Now, they said they're not sure about the legal aspects of this game.
That's archive.org all over, though, isn't it?
Yeah, they just said he just chucked the collection up trying to avoid copyright. But there's lots of lost games here.
Okay.
You know, and obscure titles, because they're saying usually when you get a games collection or a bunch of games from someone, it's the same titles that everyone's had that's mass-produced. But this has some really rare ones that haven't been in there.
Well, they've got 637 titles, apparently. And graphically, I mean, the screenshots on here as well, these look kind of cool. I didn't realise that the Apple II was actually... graphically quite as good as these screenshots would suggest.
Yeah,
so it came out in 77, it came out. I mean, you're talking 5 years before the Commodore 64.
Yeah, yeah, and, you know, these title screens are really nice. And...
yeah. Was that one here, Mystery of the Witch's Shoes? That looks pretty cool. That's the fourth one along. But the guy that's done this is a guy called 4AM, that's his handle, which you kind of get this... creates this mental image of this hacker there at 4 o'clock in the morning getting his Apple II discs and archiving them all. So.
Well, what they're saying as well is because it's on Internet Archive, it's playable.
Yeah.
So you can play it in your browser.
Yeah.
Ironically, you can't play it in Safari.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. So you can't play your own Mac games on the new Mac browser.
What has happened? Steve Wozniak will be pissed.
Yeah.
But the Apple II, the one thing I always remember about the Apple II is, do you remember there was a disc that I think everybody had at school? The Jolly Rogers cookbook.
Oh, yes. That was actually the first digitised piece of literature.
Oh, really?
So the first ever put online on BBSs was, they thought, right, we've got copyright issues, we've got copyright, this is never going to get published.
Mm-hmm.
Or, well, it was published, but let's spread it to everyone. So they uploaded the Jolly Roger, just to be controversial, I think.
Yeah. Well, it was the Anarchist Cookbook, it was called as well,
yeah,
I think, wasn't
it?
But I remember, because all my friends at school had it, we'd always, you know, copy the discs and stuff, just because you felt like, you know, an 11-year-old.
I think there was
rebel.
Lots of versions as well. There was, like... The Book of Mischief, there was hundreds of them. And you can actually get them all if you go onto...
I think they're on that text files, aren't the website?
Textfiles.com, yeah.
But I think, I remember the Amiga version of that, you'd load it up and there'd be like a little kind of readme at the beginning.
Yeah.
And it said all of these articles are typed on an Apple II, that's why they're all in uppercase. Everything was like, you know, capital letters. So that's my first introduction to the Apple II when I was a kid, like reading so that's an interesting platform.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do remember Jolly Rogers, though. No one ever tried any of the stuff in there, though, because you needed the most obscure things, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah. And you'd probably get arrested now if you actually looked at it. I don't know.
I haven't got the copy of the disc anymore, honestly.
It's strange, because it's a piece of internet history and it's a piece of cultural history that was shared completely, but... you know, after Columbine and that kind of stuff, all of that culture just got totally destroyed and, you know, can put you in prison for a long time. So that anarchist kind of thing's gone, I think, nowadays.
But even looking at, like, because I did look at it not long ago. I found my disc again. I put it in. It still worked. I remember they're talking about stuff like making, like, floppy disk, you know, kind of you'd sprinkle the matchstick heads on a floppy disk.
Yeah, yeah.
Then you put it in a drive and it'd melt your disk drive and all that. All stuff you thought, you know, I'm going to try that at school, but you obviously never
But there
did.
Was also all the different plans for the early blue boxes.
Yeah.
For the early,
they're interesting to look at now.
Yeah, it's Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak were using those guys, so it's not that bad information.
Well, I think a lot of that came from, like, Captain Crunch, you know, the guy who got the whistle tone.
Yeah,
I think some of his articles and stuff are on this collection.
But then
as
if
well.
You also look at it, it's got a lot of further box designs. Mm-hmm. So beyond the blue box when they were creating white boxes, black ones, all for different purposes.
Yeah, and it was all like, you know, hacking Marbell and stuff like that they're talking about and things. So historically, it's an interesting read to look back on it. You look back at it now for a completely different reason that you did when you were a kid. Which is, you know, I feel all cool and, like, you know, hide this just from my mum. But so yeah, that's kind of the culture that the Apple II invented. You're not going to find that on archive.org, but you know, there are some games.
And you won't find people telling you that that's the first digital book as well.
Right then, VHS videos.
Yeah, VHS videos are back and
worth money.
And worth money, man. This is crazy. Check your, like, cupboards.
So we're talking about, there's an article that's been published on, it was in the Metro. I saw it in there, and it's on the money section of AOL.co.uk. Here we're looking at. So what it is, it's the publisher's list of the most valuable VHS videotapes. Who'd have thought the VHS tapes are worth anything these days?
I guess they're the ones that haven't been digitized yet.
Yeah.
or, you know, the titles that were released and people are like, there was only a few printed.
Well, I'm looking through here. I can't say I've heard of any of these films.
No, they all seem like very odd ones.
Yeah.
Like Hitchhike to Hell.
Yeah, if you've got Hitchhike to Hell, that's worth £500. The Curse of Death, that sounds nice, that's £700. The Beast in Heat.
The Beast in Heat.
That's £1,200 if you've got a copy of that in your attic. And Frankenstein's Castle of Freaks is the top one, yeah, £1,500.
Maybe these are for, like, you know, like James Rolfe or like the horror film collector guys, you know, kind of really into these old school VHSs.
They do sound it. They sound like boo movies, don't they?
Yeah.
I've got some VHS tapes still, but it's stuff like Nutty Professor and I found it. My girlfriend's got a copy of Raggy Dolls on VHS. So.
Well, I used to be into kung fu movies a lot of really hardcore kung fu movies, and quite a lot would be banned from the UK. And it wasn't. It was because they couldn't class it in certification because it was too extreme for other stuff. And you'd often get VHS copies of other versions, import and stuff.
Like from Japan and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And Shogun Assassin was a massive one. That eventually, the ban got lifted and it got commercially released. But for years, everyone was swapping Shogun Assassin. It kind of inspired Mortal Kombat.
Oh, okay. Is that, I've seen the video
like,
about that.
You know,
before.
The look of Raiden and Scorpion.
But the best way to make a movie, like, you know, a cult classic is to ban it, though, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it. You know, you're going to get the press and everyone's going to want to see a banned movie.
So, if you want to check your attic for any of these tapes that you may have lying around at home, unlikely due to the fact that we've never heard of them, but we'll pop a link to the full list in the show notes at theretrohour.com. Getting back to the Spectrum, there have been a few new games out for the Spectrum recently. You know, I mentioned before about how the Spectrum's kind of got a bit of a personality and a sense of humour.
Yeah, like School Days and Complete Bastard.
Well, check out this new title. It's called Husband Chores.
Husband Chores.
So what this is a husband simulator.
Oh, God.
Now, neither Ravi or I are married currently.
No, we're not looking for husbands either.
I will be a husband next year as I'm getting married next October.
Get some practice in, Dan.
Yeah, well, looking at this, I haven't got much to look forward to. So basically, you play a typical husband who's been told by the wife he must keep the house clean. So you've got to run around, you've got to do stuff like cleaning the toilets, taking out the rubbish, stopping things piling up, waiting for the dustbin man to come. So it basically is like a side-on view of this house. You've just got to run around and do all the chores while the wife nags you by the looks of
it. And it gets more chaotic. Is there an actual nagging wife, or is she?
I'm not sure, actually, looking at this, so... It's typical Spectrum graphics. I'm sure it's quite wacky. There seems to be a big Christmas tree in the background as well. So, but yeah, apparently this is written in assembly language as well, in Z80.
Oh, nice.
So
so it'd be pretty fast.
But again, it's just, I think there needs to be a wife version of this, though, as well.
Totally.
Yeah. Fetch me a beer.
Totally.
Yeah. And if Samantha's listening, of course, I'm not like that. I'm scared now. Right, then, next one. Super Mario Brothers with the Flappy Bird code injection.
So this is it's been spread a lot around the internet, but I don't think people know exactly what it is. And it's absolutely insane what this guy's done. Basically, he's used glitches within the game.
Okay, what is this within Super Mario World?
Within Super Mario World, to be able to inject the code. Now, he's put the code of Flappy Bird in, so the source code of how to play Flappy Bird. He's managed to do it, but the way that he does it is he's stuck a load of multi-taps in, taped down some of the buttons, and then by doing glitches, he can move to certain coordinates on the map and fire shells at certain places. That will start to input the code, and he basically builds the game using glitches and Mario to the point that the whole Flappy Bird code is in there.
Yeah.
And suddenly Mario, the level, gets converted into Flappy Bird.
So, yeah, when I first heard about this set, I mean, this is Super Mario World for the Super Nintendo. I assumed it was just kind of, you know, he took the graphics from it and put it into Flappy Bird, but it's not then. It's a mod of the original code then.
The original code, and he's jumping up precisely on the pixel spots to send in commands.
Dude, that's correct. Because, I mean, Flappy Bird anyway looks like graphics from Mario, doesn't it? You know, you've got kind of the pipes and stuff around you.
Yeah. So if you watch the video of it online...
I'm watching it now, yeah.
You get to around, he's on 33 seconds.
Yeah.
And it just drops. Like, he's inputted all the code in.
Yeah.
And the Mario wheel just goes, and suddenly the Flappy Bird code comes in.
Yeah, and it's just the pipes, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Inside of it.
It's absolutely crazy.
It looks perfect as well.
Yeah, so. There's just a bit of colour mess up, and then that's about it. But they've started to use, like, kind of multi-taps and stuff to inject stuff so they can make Snake on Mario with Mario's head.
It's cool just doing that, though, isn't it? These games that you've loved all your life, just being able to like mess around with them and manipulate them in that way.
Yeah, but you know, this I've never seen this kind of code injection through glitches. It's incredibly, you have to be incredibly high skilled to do that.
Now, I thought this one was quite interesting. It's always quite good to look back on old systems and see how people reacted to them at the time, I think. And Mashable have compiled this list of computer reviews from the dawn of technology. So it's basically reviews of machines from 1975 up until...
So when they just came out.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. And the first one here is a machine called the RGS-008A Microcomputer Kit. And this is a review from 1975. It sells for $375, making this one of the least expensive kits on the market.
Wow.
So that was from Byte Magazine, which is no longer around anymore, Byte Magazine, I don't think. But that was one of the kind of the, you know, the big American mags back then, I think.
I think they might be online.
Are they? Okay. Maybe. And there's a user report of the PET, the Commodore PET, 2001 from 1978. The Commodore PET sells for $595 and includes keyboard, video display, cassette drive, and 4K of programmable memory. Ooh. Have you ever used a Commodore PET before?
I've never used one. I've seen them.
They're cool looking machines.
Yeah, they look really nice, but I'd be lost. I wouldn't know what to type
in. We had one at school.
Oh, nice.
Now, I'm not as old as I'm making myself out to sound here, but I remember at my school in the library, you kind of went into this this room near the library at school where like the, you know, the library monitors and all that kind of hung out. And in there at the corner, they had loads of old crap they just put there. And there was a Commodore PET there. And I remember I said to the library monitor, being a complete nerd, I said, "Yo, can I come in at lunchtime and get that old computer working?" And she's like, "Oh, I think we've got some disks and all that." So I did actually manage to get the machine up and running.
Nice.
And it added like Commodore Basic 7.0 or something like that on it. And it had like, I think it might have even been 8-inch floppy disks, like the really big ones. And I'd loaded like a few old, it was just stuff like old spreadsheets and that from the late 70s.
Yeah.
But when I left school, that machine was still in there. And like, you know, like my school actually got demolished in about 2003. So I'm thinking now, you know, that computer's probably been thrown in a skip or something, but...
Well, they're pretty hardcore. It might have survived underneath all the rubble.
Probably, isn't it? Yeah. There's also a review of the Hewlett-Packard, the new personal computer, the first ever Sinclair Research ZX80.
Oh, and the Osborne one. This is great because I remember you were telling me about Usenet when they had the early reviews of Usenet, and they were like...
The first mentions, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it can fit on your lap, the C64, and you know, this kind of...
Well, this year they got the first review of Microsoft Windows as well, and the review of the first Mac as well. Words they used, amazing and fun. But this is like, it's just good to look back on kind of how people reacted to things at the time. Because I think, you know, often stuff gets clouded a lot in this day and age by not only stuff that you've read in magazines over the years, but also stuff like YouTube reviews and that kind of thing. Mm. Often, you know, the opinion on something can change from what it was back then.
Well, also companies can form the opinion, you know, they can force it. So, you know, the successful ones we hear about and the unsuccessful ones we don't. But they could have been better machines, you know.
Yeah.
It's just who won. And which one remains in the hearts of people.
Yeah, the best machines very rarely win the war, do they?
They don't. It's usually the cheapest or the kind of most available.
Well, I remember there was there's a video on YouTube of like an old BBC program, like the computer program or something it was called back in the early 80s. And I've seen the clip where he's got the Amiga 1000 there, the first Amiga, and he's demoing it with the mouse and stuff and like, you know, showing like menus and things. And the fact that then, and that means people in Britain who, you know, the shows were all about like BBC Micros and stuff before that.
Yeah.
And then introducing this massive new leap in technology, people must be like, what the hell is that? You know what I mean? So.
But then they would have gone out and bought the Amstrad because it was cheaper.
Yeah, yeah. Or the Spectrum.
Yeah.
Now, I thought this is quite an interesting little thread that I was looking at the other day. Your favourite hacker or computer movies?
Oh, man. Favourite hacker or computer movies? I'd have to say the one is Freedom Downtime. I don't know if you've seen that.
Yeah, the Kevin Mitnick documentary,
yes,
is it? Yeah,
yeah, by 2600.
Yeah, okay. What was that about? Like 90s, was it?
Yeah, it was about the world's most notorious hacker, Kevin Mitnick. And it was all about how they were basically gone completely overboard when they'd arrested him. And they put him in solitary confinement. They said he'd start a nuclear war.
Yeah, yeah.
From using a payphone.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah.
And, it was crazy what happened to him.
It was mad, but that's a really good movie because it kind of explains the whole story and just shows how the kind of they're still doing it, the ridiculous treatment of hackers, like Neil McKinnon as well. They're trying to extradite him at the moment.
Yeah, yeah.
And they still want to send some hackers to Guantanamo Bay, which is not good, you know?
Yeah, leaking information. They don't like it, do they?
No, no.
But speaking of Kevin Mitnick as well, there's also the dramatised version of it. Was it Takedown or something?
Takedown, yeah, which was the book. It was a book that they'd wrote, and then they based a movie on it.
I think, though, didn't he try to sue them or something? He said, like, this is literally nothing, not even remotely what happened.
Yeah, it was a total, like, dramatised but rubbish dramatisation of it, you know.
So, I mean, actually, watching it, though, I thought it was an interesting film, but then when you learn, like, literally, like, that's not how it happened. Yeah. It was all just the Hollywood version
of it.
It's
like Kevin Mitnick beating up people in alleyways. And it's like, no, he was a big geek who was just harmless.
So if you want to get the actual look at how it happened, the documentary is the way to go, isn't it?
And by the way, he's reformed. So you can check out, I think it's mitnick.com.
Yeah.
And he runs a security consultancy.
Yeah, as a lot of the old hackers do. Yeah, yeah, I mean, they're the best people to do it, I guess. Speaking of which, remember, you know, Hackers the Movie? Did you ever watch that back in the old days?
Hackers the Movie,
Angelina Jolie, dude, with that little kind of elfin look.
Do you remember the Hackers the Movie website got hacked?
Did it?
Yeah, they changed all the pictures, so it was Spice Girls.
Oh,
and
no
they
way.
Also made them all bold. and they were like, they changed it to not real hackers. And it
was like, Hackers of the Movie, it's like, I know it's an awful film.
Yeah.
But it is nostalgic of that kind of era of computers. There's some ridiculous quotes in there. What's like, Risk is going to change everything. Do you remember that one? They're like tapping on the keyboard and stuff and hearing the specs of the machine and things. And,
but it's that kind of thing where, you know, they used to do this in movies all the time. Where you'd sit there and you'd enter the information superhighway and it'd be all these zooming graphics around.
But I guess, you know, if you just had a guy there typing into a DOS terminal, it wouldn't be the most exciting
and drinking
visual
coffee.
Aspect, would it? Yeah, eating pizza. But Hackers, I think, the soundtrack on it's really good as well. And it's got the first appearance of Wipeouts in there as well.
Yeah,
you know, he's in the arcade and stuff. And it is a ridiculous film, but I think it's just...
And we can't not mention War Games as well.
Oh, dude, yeah, absolutely.
You know, if you haven't seen War Games, then go watch it now. It's great. After listening to us, of course.
Well, War Games, it was one of those films when I was a kid. You'd watch it, and it's just that scene, isn't it, when he's in his bedroom and he changes his grades on the computer.
Yeah, yeah.
Every kid wanted to do that, didn't they?
And the girl's like, change it back!
Yeah. Yeah,
it's great.
And I love Gallagher, the game, after seeing it there. I always wanted to find Gallagher, and I found it in the seaside once. And
Well, another thing is actually, I mentioned Ready Player One the other day, which was this really good book that's just come out about old retro games. They've just announced that Steven Spielberg's going to be doing the movie.
All right, okay.
So it's going to be kind of super 80 style. Mm-hmm. So we'll have a look out for that.
Absolutely.
That'd be another good movie.
Do you remember The Net with Sandra Bullock?
The Net? Was that where they kind of harassed her?
Yeah, and then they took her identity, didn't they?
Oh, I love Sandra Bullock. Any film.
Yeah, it's worth watching for Sandra Bullock.
Yeah.
The film is good at the beginning. It's got kind of a bit where she's like this like lonely kind of technology hacker who's a bit socially awkward and... Yeah. And she goes on pizza.com, I remember. And it's like 1995 and orders a pizza. At the time, I was like, that looks ridiculous. Obviously, you can order Domino's now on your phone, can't you?
Yeah.
But there's a lot of those films, I think, from that era. Just looking back at technology and you realise how far we've come on, how alien it looked back then, and things that we take for granted and you can do every day.
Well, also The Matrix as well, but The Matrix was kind of more out there. But it was based on Ghost in the Shell, which was another really good.
Was that like an anime kind of...
Anime manga one.
Yeah. And there was Lawnmower Man as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always remember that virtual reality is going to be amazing, but... Yeah, we're not quite there yet. So, yeah, there's a few suggestions if you're interested in nerdy hacker movies.
There's another one as well that I've mentioned, which is to do with the dot-com boom.
I was watching that on YouTube the other day, actually.
Yeah,
it's kind of a look at what happened in around 2000, 2001, when it all kind of... Was it What Went Wrong, it was called, wasn't it?
Yeah, What Went Wrong. And it was kind of like, you know, everyone got so excited when it came out, the internet. They were just chucking money at it.
Yeah.
You got quite a bit of
I did, yeah. Success, I had about three websites then, funding my way through university doing it, yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy. And, you know, these people were just willing to chuck stuff at them. Mm-hmm. And then it all completely collapsed.
It did go wrong, yeah. Well, the big one I remember was Boo.com.
Boo.com, okay.
Yeah, they were in Carnaby Street in London. They were kind of the first, they were meant to be the first kind of, a lot of people might remember the story. I think there was a BBC documentary done about them a few years ago. But, like you said, companies were just throwing money, and they burnt through, I think, £185 million of investor money in about 12 months, and then spectacularly went bankrupt. There's actually a book about it called Boohoo. So I've got it at home. It's a really good read, actually, though, just seeing. Of course, all the staff were like late teens, early 20s. They'd never run a company before. They didn't, you know.
Never run a
bookshop or something.
That was the thing. They all tried to start this thing, but the model wasn't there. The e-commerce model wasn't there, you know.
Yeah.
Amazon now, and nearly half the stuff bought online is now through Amazon.
Yeah, yeah.
But before, they were tiny, and
You can buy milk off Amazon now, can't you?
Yeah, yeah. But some people actually thought Amazon wouldn't survive the dot-com crash.
Yeah. You know? Absolutely. Well, there's just so many different online companies back then. But yeah, it's a really interesting documentary, though. It's about 45 minutes long, isn't it? It's on YouTube. So yeah, these are a few of our little suggestions. If you want some watching material, we'll pop a few of these in the show notes. We'll have a look at theretrohour.com. And before we get to Jim Bagley then, we've still got a bit of face paint on today, haven't we?
Oh yeah, I've been washing it off. My face hurts. But
some people have been asking, so we posted a picture on our Facebook page, didn't we? Of you and I, you're wearing a camouflage.
Oh, yeah, I just wear camouflage as normal.
Yeah, you're wearing it anyway when I rang you. But we've been playing this new Amiga game. Now, we did talk about this when it first got announced back in January, didn't we? Tanks Furry, we still don't know how to say it.
Yeah, Tanks Furry, yeah.
So we've actually played it now, though.
Yeah, it's really good.
It is.
We're going to shove a review on YouTube.
Yeah, so we've been filming it this afternoon, just before we did the podcast, and I've got to say, I think, you know, just to give my initial impressions of this game, for those that are not familiar with it at all, it is an Amiga game that was made for, I think it was a demo competition last year. You can download it for free, or they do offer like a proper physical boxed copy of it that's very cheap, isn't it? It's like, what, £6 or something?
Yeah, about €8.
Not very much at all. I've got to give props to Marvin for sending us a copy.
And sending us war paint.
Yeah, we didn't go out and buy the war paint, not wearing in the video and the pictures. Yeah, thank you for that, Marvin. And... it is two-player gaming in its rawest form, isn't it?
Yeah, it's sitting next to each other, shooting, you know, getting...
Joysticks in hand on the couch.
It's great.
That sounded wrong. but it is just, you know, it took you back to being a kid again. I think if that game was around when I was like 10, 12 years old...
I would have caned it. Yeah, I would have had all your mates around and be playing weird key combinations on the keyboard because you'd run out of control.
Yeah, it's a four-player game as well, isn't it? I mean, I think you need to have like some kind of parallel port hack to enable two other joystick ports on the Amiga to play it, but we were on a two-player game before. Ravi was on his Zip Stick and I was on my QJ joystick. Who won the game?
Oh, you'll have to watch to find out that.
Yeah, so the video should be up actually at the time of this podcast going out on Friday, so we'll pop a link to that in the show notes and on Facebook as well, or just search for Dan Wood on YouTube. You'll find me, top of the list. So it's just cool to have a new Amiga game in 2016 as well, though, isn't it? So,
yeah, and for classic Amiga, because...
Yeah, it is.
All these games recently are ports of Linux stuff that gets put onto the new Amiga operating system, which I don't have. So it's good to have the
Not
old
many people
one.
Do. No. But this is, it runs on like any Amiga with, I think it's 1.5 megabytes of RAM it's got to have, and an O20.
O20 processor, CPU. Yeah. So like a cheap upgrade card or something.
I mean, only you can get these, you know, we talked about the Vampire Accelerator the other week, that's only like £120, or you can get like, you know, one of the O30 ones. Isn't the one that sells for like £55 for on the Amiga kit?
Yeah.
So, the O20 one, isn't it?
You can buy an upgrade later on as well to get it going faster.
Yeah, it unlocks it, doesn't it? Yeah. But they're cool. I mean, I think if you are going to set up an Amiga game system, it's worth having a little bit of extra memory and a slightly faster CPU.
Yeah, it needs that little extra kick to get the stuff out there.
Yeah, or if you want to run like WHD load instead of using disk, you can run them all off your hard disk, and then it's a little bit of extra RAM does come in handy, and you can play Tanks Fury.
Yes, definitely. Looking forward to playing lots of new Amiga games as well.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, we're going to play at the end of the month. We should bring a little Amiga setup and a little game of Tanks Fury there.
Oh, it's going to be getting everyone back to the hotel room, isn't it? I'm in a Tanks Fury session.
Right, guys, thank you so much for checking out episode 14 of The Retro Hour, which you can download every Friday from our website, theretrohour.com, on iTunes, SoundCloud, YouTube, all over your favourite podcast clients.
Yeah, Stitcher, Overcast, Pocket Cast.
Sunny Day.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we'll be back next Friday, and we will hand you over to this week's special guest, the Portmaster,
Jim Bagley.
Background on you would be quite interesting. What first got you into games?
Well, I used to enjoy playing games, and then when I went to high school, they had the BBC Model B and six sharp MZ80Ks, and they were, everyone would be like queuing up to play on the BBC, and then I'd realised that you can actually play as close to an arcade game as you can get on a home computer, and so I thought, well, if you can do that, then you must be able to program them. And so I thought, if I learn to program them, I'll be able to make my own games instead of like going to the arcade of the weekend and
save you 10 pences.
I can save me 10 pences and make my own games.
I think the BBC Micro is probably responsible for a lot of kids getting interested in computers back then. Would you say?
Yeah, well, it was in schools, wasn't it? So,
what was your first machine at home then?
ZX81. I used to write a load of basic programs for games. Well, it started the first programming that I did was on the Sharp MZ80K in school. The teacher was a maths teacher who they said, well, you know maths, you can teach computers. Obviously, couldn't. I ended up teaching myself faster than he could teach him and then teach the kids. So I was like way past him.
So you kind of took over from him then.
Yeah. And so I carried on with my thirst for knowledge of wanting to make games, and so I'd be making my own games instead of copying out of the books. I'd be making my own stuff, because I'd got to the point where I typed stuff out the books and realised what bits were doing what in the book, and then so I'd start making my own games on the Sharp MZ80K while I was waiting for my go on the BBC to play a game.
You've obviously worked on loads of different systems. I mean, those early 8-bit days to the modern era. Did you have a favourite machine of that era then, that kind of like your early days that you've got most affinity for?
Have to be the Speccy, wouldn't it?
Did you get caught up much in the Commodore 64 versus Spectrum war then?
Not really. It was mainly Speccy where we were. We had a few people who loved the 64, but there's never arguments of ours is better, yours is better. It was just whatever friend's house we were at, whether mine or I was at theirs or whatever. If they had the 64, we played on the 64. If they had the Speccy, we played on the Speccy. If they had an Amstrad, we played on an Amstrad or whatever.
So you mentioned the Amstrad there as well.
Yeah.
You've done a lot of ports for the system. What do you think about it?
I do actually quite like the Amstrad. It's sort of underrated because of the speed of it due to the size of the screen. When I was doing my ports, unfortunately, we were only porting to the Amstrad because I was saying, well, why aren't we doing an Amstrad version? And he said, well, go on then. So I ended up like being lumbered with the Amstrad version and no artist to do it because they were busy getting the art ready for the next Spectrum game that I was doing.
So it's kind of a case of you did it because no one else was.
Yeah, because I thought my Amstrad friends were missing out, and so I did my bit for them.
Do you think the Amstrad was an underrated platform?
Yeah, because it was a nice machine. The sound was okay. I mean, it wasn't a SID chip, but then none of the others could beat the Commodore 64 sound back in the day. The colours were really good. I think I preferred the Amstrad colour range than the Commodore 64 and the Speccy. So it had a nice collection.
Yeah, because I was seeing that you'd also done a lot of conversions of modern games, well, not so modern, like Dragon's Lair for the ZX81.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, how do you do that?
Yeah, well, the reason the ZX81 port of Dragon's Lair came out back in 2012 when I did Pac-Manic Minor Man, which was Manic Miner for Pac-Man hardware. I don't know if you saw any of that.
Yeah, it was on the Pac-Man board, wasn't it?
Played on the Pac-Man PCB and just changed, rewrote the ROMs to play Manic Miner. The reason I did that was I was searching the net for Pac-Man hints and tips, and I come across the memory map for Pac-Man, and because I know Z80 and Inside Out, I thought I've got to make a game for Pac-Man hardware, because back in the 80s I converted a load of arcade games to the Speccy and Amstrad, and I always wanted to make an arcade game back then. So obviously when I found Pac-Man memory map, I decided that I have to make a game for Pac-Man hardware so I can actually finally my childhood dream and make an arcade game.
Like the holy grail that was, yeah?
Yeah, it was. Once I'd finished that, it was like, well, what can I do now? And obviously with having a love for all things retro, I decided that I'll do a ZX81 game, because when I had my ZX81, I only knew BASIC. It wasn't until I got a Speccy that I started doing machine code. So I never got to do any games for ZX81 in machine code. And so after doing Pac-Manic Minor Man, I decided to do a ZX81 game. So I did Jim Bagley's ZX81 Racing, which was a high-res game for the ZX81. And then after that, I was saying, I wonder what else I can do, because I wanted to do another game for the ZX81, because I quite enjoyed doing the driving game. I was talking with Andy Spencer, who runs Retro Computer Museum, RCM, and they were saying, what shall I do next? He was like trying to come up with an idea, and I said, I wonder if it can play video on ZX81. And he said, don't be stupid. I said, if it can play video, I'll be able to do something like Dragon's Lair or something. He said, get out of it. Well, he didn't say that, but I don't want to say what he said.
slightly stronger.
So I said, well, tell you what, give me a bit of time and I'll see if it can be done. I went off flying for a bit, come back a bit later. So I sent him a copy of the image, and he was like, oh my God. And then after that, I thought, right, I've got to convert the whole of the video for it. And that took a while. And then I was originally using some free software to convert the video to black or white. I wasn't overly keen with the way it was coming out, whether it was the settings I was using on it or what, I didn't know. And I thought it'd be easier to just write my own, and then I can make it do what kinds of things I want to do. So I spent the next month of evenings trying different methods of getting a full screen, full colour cartoon sequence down to 128x96 in either black or white pixels.
I know that everyone that's listening to this now is going to be like, how on earth is that even possible?
I know, yeah.
how do you even store it in such a small memory space and stuff?
Well, it was each frame of the image is 1.5K. Because the ZX81 has no real hardware help for actually drawing the screen to the TV, the Z80 has to do it. So the only time you've actually got control of the Z80 is when it's not in screen time.
Didn't even the screen blank when you're loading games and stuff, didn't it, on the ZX81?
Yeah, it used to. But with the ZXpand card that a good friend of mine, Charlie Robson, made, it gives you 32K of RAM, and it also gives you access to an SD card, but it gets the data off the SD card and feeds it to the ZX81 when you need it. Now you tell it to load a sector, it'll go away and load a sector, leaving the Z80 to do whatever it needs to do to keep the screen active.
Well, one of the mad things that I saw was on your YouTube channel, you'd actually, with the Dragon's Lair player, showed video of like GTA 5 and Call of Duty and stuff.
Yeah. I just converted a couple of videos, a couple of random videos. When I was doing the video converter, like when you're converting an image to black and white, it's not too bad because it's just a single image. So you get what colour ranges or kind of settings you need to get it to convert it down to black or white. But when it's a whole video, it's a lot more complicated because scenes can change, lighting can change, colours can change.
Do you ever think that when you were a kid, if you saw the kind of stuff you can do now on this platform,
it
would have blown your mind?
The funny thing is, someone said to me, so if this is on a ZX81, how many tapes would that be? And it turns out, if you used C90s. You'd have to have 74 C90s.
My word.
Just a stack.
Obviously, it wouldn't be very fast playing a video.
I would like to wait for that loading time.
One frame an hour, maybe.
It is insane, though, isn't it? And I think, you know, I've had discussions with people before. Do you think this is why you come back to real hardware over emulation?
It probably is, you know. When you're emulating on a PC, the whole thing is different because most people who play games on emulators are reminiscent from the childhood days when they played it when they were younger or whatever. Mm-hmm. So when you're playing it on, like, a PC keyboard and you're using a ZX81, which didn't have a PC keyboard, the feel that is different. Same with the Speccy, the rubber keyboard. It's a lot different to a PC keyboard, and the Commodore 64 keyboard, that's a big clunky keyboard, which is different to the PC keyboards now. So it's all to get the same feeling from every aspect of not just playing the game, but how your fingers, like, interacted with the keyboard and stuff like that.
I've noticed recently as well there's been a bit of a resurgence in interest in the Spectrum. Have you seen kind of these new remakes of it that have been coming out?
The Vega, yeah.
What do you think of all that?
I think they're ace. I quite like it. I've got one myself as well. The fact that they've added the ULA Plus functionality to it makes it more enjoyable, because the fact that you can start making newer games with enhanced graphics for it as well, which is pretty cool. So I'll be doing some of them at some point further down the line.
Yeah, because we've kind of noticed in our podcast a new market, which is a retro demakes.
Yeah.
And I guess with this Spectrum Vega Plus and stuff, there may start to be demakes coming onto that.
Yeah. Well, apparently I've heard that some other people are doing a ULA Plus mod for old Speccies, so you'd be able to upgrade your Speccy to have the new ULA chip that allows the extra colours and stuff.
So another more kind of modern title that you did was Doom for the Sega Saturn. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it was about 21 years ago now.
Yeah, not that modern.
Basically, I used to play Doom a lot in lunch hour and after work with the rest of the guys in the office. One day, Paul Finnegan, the boss, came in and said, Jim, you know you like playing Doom? I said, yeah. I said, do you fancy converting it to the Saturn? I was like, too right to do. So they got me all the SDK and the hardware, and got to work, porting Saturn, putting Doom to Saturn. And I got it all running full screen, full frame rate, and sent it back off to ID for approval. And it was like a demo for them to approve, making sure that they're happy with the progress and stuff. About 3 days later, I got a phone call back from John Carmack saying, oh, I can't use the hardware to render the walls and stuff.
So you had to do it in software rendering?
I had to be doing software rendering like the PC. I was like, why are you doing this? It's going to be slow. No, I don't like the. No, I don't want you using the hardware. It's got to be like the PC. It's like, okay, fair enough. So anyway, I scrapped it and doing it. It wasn't anywhere near as fast as it would have been, but it wasn't too bad. We ended up porting the PSX version because it was like we need to do something quick, and then converted it, got it out. And then two, possibly even three now, years ago, I went to Retro Revival in Wolverhampton.
We were probably there at the same time.
Very, very possibly, because that was on where John Romero was. And we built up in there at the same time. And caught up to John Romero because we were both doing talks and stuff, so we never got a chance to actually talk to each other. But I made sure I said, no, I need to ask you a few questions. I need to talk to you about Doom on the Saturn. And so any chance we can like have lunch together? So he said, yeah, sure. We were only supposed to have like about half an hour, 45-minute lunch break. We ended up chatting for about an hour and a half and extended our lunch and went into the time we should have been doing our talks. But I had a great chat with him. He's a lovely bloke, really nice. And I said to him, it's been 19 years since I wrote Doom. One thing I've always wanted to know was, why did you kneecap it? Why did you not let me use the 3D hardware, you know, considering I had it running full screen, full frame rate? John says he was the person who was doing all the approvals for Doom. And when it was time for the Saturn Doom approval, he was on a holiday that week, and John Carmack taken over and done the approval, and obviously denied it. But John Romero said if he'd have seen it running full screen, full frame rate, he'd have told me to finish it off, and when I finished, go back and brought it back to the PC.
No way.
It was nice to have that like closure at the end of it, but it was like it was also gutting because I was constantly thinking, well, how much would things have changed, you know, if it had come out at being the way it was going to be?
How did you feel when you saw the reviews after the game came out?
They were honest, really. It wasn't the fastest version of Doom that was out there, but for what we had to play with, as good as the Saturn could get, I reckon.
You know, you mentioned then like events like Revival and that kind of thing. Do you think there's been a resurgence in the interest in these retro platforms over the last few years? Where do you think it's come from?
I don't know. The first one I went to was Bike back in 2009. Mm-hmm. I met quite a lot of friends, good friends there. Funnily enough, it was in the queue waiting for food because there was only one woman serving, and she was serving one at a time. So the queue, as you can imagine, was massive. But that ended up being probably one of the best things about that event because it forged so many friendships.
So are you planning on going to the Play Blackpool event?
Well, they've asked me to do a Q&A on the Guinness Record thing with the Dragon's Lair. So, yeah, I'll be going to the... I go to all the Play events anyway.
So how did you actually get the Guinness Record officially authorised then? Did they have to come down and check it? Or?
When I was doing Dragon's Lair, I hadn't thought about it being a world record that I was going to be doing when I did it. I got my daughter interested in 2012, and she's had all the books, both the gaming one and the normal Guinness World Record book, since 2012. And she always said, like, wouldn't it be great to get into the Guinness Book of Records? I'd love to be in the Guinness Book of Records, but I'm not the strongest woman in the world or not the fastest woman in the world. So I'd say to her, like, well, you don't have to be the fastest or the strongest, you just have to think of something that hasn't had a record done before. So anyway, and then gets to doing the Dragon's Lair, and someone mentioned, I don't know, I think it was on Facebook, that it's got to be the biggest game now for the ZX81, and it just clicked. It's like, yeah, I need to show my daughter that, you know, get the record for it, get myself into the record books. It'll prove to her that you don't have to be like the biggest, strongest person or the fastest person to do anything to get in there. You just need to do something different. So applied for the record, and sometime later, after back and forth and on deciding, they had to like come up with a measurement, what it is that somebody has to do to in order to beat this record.
Did someone hold it already, did they?
No.
Okay.
I said it's the largest game for the ZX81 because the largest one that I know of before this was 48K, and obviously at 15 meg I've got it beat somewhat.
What was your daughter's reaction then when you got in?
Absolutely amazed. Well, buzzing about it. She can't wait to get the book to see me in it.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, we'll have to get a copy of that one. The Gaming Guinness Book of Records,
yeah.
Is it?
Yeah, sounds exciting. Yeah. So what are you working on at the moment then?
Game-wise, I'm working on Bomb Jack for the Vectrex.
Right, okay. Interesting platform.
Wow, for the Vectrex as well. Yeah.
Ravi was telling the story that apparently engineers panic whenever Vectrex come to like retro conventions because all the power suddenly saps from the room.
I know, yeah. So, yeah, a friend of mine when I was at school had a Vectrex and I liked it. And I also liked the Star Wars cabinet because I used to have one at one point. And so I always liked the idea of being able, wanting to do, as well as wanting to do an arcade game, but wanting to do a Vector game on Vector TV. Just because it's different to the way the normal raster TVs work.
It always had a beautiful look, I think, the Vectrex.
It did, didn't it? Yeah. So, like I say, I wanted to make it. And so after doing Dragon's Lair, I did Dragon's Lair for the Acorn Atom as well. And then I thought I'd best leave Dragon's Lair alone for a bit now because I don't want to be pushing me luck with putting too many versions of Dragon's Lair out. So I decided what should I do next. And then Vectrex, yeah, it's got to be that. It was seen at the one of the shows and thought, yeah, that's the next challenge. I do really need to get back and finish off Double Dragon, but I've got so many things that I need to do first.
Are you kind of attracted to these kind of more obscure platforms then?
Yeah, I think it's more it's going back and doing stuff that I didn't get to back in the day. Mm-hmm. Like I never got to program the Vectrex or ZX81. I didn't get to do any machine code on the ZX81. I didn't get to do like an arcade game, but I've done that now. I suppose it is just the tying up loose ends, maybe. I don't know. Doing the old stuff that were always there in the back of my mind that I wanted to do, but never actually was able to. Now I am able to.
We know from the reaction, Jim, that obviously, you know, the community and all of the fans of these systems, you know, just love seeing your work as well. So that must be quite a buzz when you...
Yeah, it's amazing. It's weird. I've got just the fact of having fans, it's mind-blowing. It's great, the fact that, you know, they love my work. I mean, I try and make them as playable as possible, and they are games after all, and games are supposed to be playable. When I'm making the games, I have that in mind, that it needs to be fun to play, and the fact that, like say, I've got a fan base that do enjoy it, it's quite heartwarming, even, that they're all there and, you know, egging me on and, you know, happy for me when I do get things like Guinness World Record and stuff like that. And it was weird. I was out at a club. The music guy at work's a DJ, and on Friday he was playing in Liverpool, and so I went over to see him. I was just sitting there. These three guys came over, and one goes, "You look awfully familiar. You look like that French rugby player." Okay, fair enough. And I said, "Sorry, I don't follow rugby, so I haven't got a clue who you're talking about." So he got his phone out and Googled French rugby player, and it showed a picture of like this big guy with like long hair. And said, "Oh yeah, he's got long hair, hasn't he? Yeah, I can see the resemblance." And so anyway, the other guy that was with him says, "I know who you do look like." And he said, "So I said who?" He said, "Have you seen a movie called?" Bedroom to Billions. I said, "Yeah, now that is me." I was in that, and all three of them, the faces lit up. "Really? Oh, can we have our photo with you?" So ended up chatting for like the next 20-30 minutes about games and stuff. It was good, and that was the first time outside a computer event like, you know, Play and Retro Revival that I'd been recognised.
Must have been surreal though.
It was very surreal. It was nicer.
Well, Jim, it's been amazing talking to you. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast this week. It's been great to get your story.
It's been a pleasure.
And hopefully we'll bump into you at Play Expo.
Look out for that. That'd be nice, yeah. Look out for us.
Look out for the French rugby player.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot then, Jim.
Yeah, thank you. No worries.